turning out on this wet, cold June day. It's not really summer weather, but we really appreciate that you've come along to join us this evening. Before we get started, I have a few housekeeping notes. Mainly, we have a lovely PowerPoint slide here, which is your safety information. So if you do hear a fire alarm, please make your way out of the auditorium and to the meeting place on the plaza outside the building. With that, I think we'll get started with our event this evening. My name is Dr. Penny Bickle. I'm a lecturer in the archaeology department here at the University of York, and I convened the debate this evening and invited some of really leading specialists who are doing interesting and challenging work around inequality. Before I introduce them, I just want to say a few words about why an archaeologist and a prehistorian is interested in questions of inequality. I study the beginning of farming, of the transition from hunting and gathering to farming, some 7,000-8,000 years ago, and I am interested in questions about social diversity, so how things like identity and gender and differences between what people were eating and their access to resources were shaping those societies. And in researching that, I found that we were saying a lot of myths about what those societies were like. And some of those myths about access to resources seem to be impacting on how we were thinking about inequality today. The kind of stories that we tell about who we are shape how we approach the world. And those stories, if they're based on assumptions or on unexamined myths, can have an impact then on how we think we can challenge and face some of the injustices and inequalities that we see in the world around us. So what I wanted to do was to get this great group of people together to talk a little bit about how they approach inequality and how perhaps some of the ways in which people have faced inequality and challenged inequality in the past could help us today. So I'm going to introduce our panel. I'm then going to ask them to say a few words about their perspectives, and then we're going to open the floor up to you to ask us questions and to get the debate started. So, to start with, on my left, on your far right, is David Wengrow. He's joined us from the University College London. He's an archaeologist. He's the Professor of Comparative Archaeology. He's known for publishing some books called What is Civilization? So a great question, what is civilization and the origin of monsters? And he's working with the anthropologist David Graeber at the moment, kind of questioning the origins of social inequality and what are those questions that we want to be asking. Then next to me here is Professor Kate Pickett. She's here from the University of York and may be familiar to many of you with Richard Wilkinson. She's published something called The Spirit Level, a volume which was sort of a robust critique of how inequality in society leads to further problems. So the more unequal we are, the more problems they are. And recently out in paperback, the same robust approach to mental health and how inequality, large gaps in inequality, are affecting our mental health. So that's called The Inner Level, and you can buy it from all good bookshops and outside after the talk. And then last but not least, on my right, on your left, is Danny Dorling from the University of Oxford. He's a professor of human geography, has done some really interesting and challenging things with inequality, especially thinking about positively about how we can confront it and what kind of political changes we can bring about. Last year he published Peak Inequality, debating whether we'd reached the peak of inequality or not. And then this year, with Sally Tomlinson, has published Rule Britannia, A Positive Approach to Brexit, I understand. So again, available outside. Okay, so thank you very much for coming along and to our great speakers. We're going to start with David as the prehistorian. So we'd start with the early part, and then we'll invite Kate and then Danny to set out their approach. And the question that I set them in the notes was, what can we learn from the prehistory of inequality, or what would we like to know from historical approaches to inequality? Over to you, David.
And the answer, possibly, beginning with, well, I'll try. Thank you very much. Is my mic?
Yeah.
doing something. It sounds like it. Thank you very much, Penny, for this invitation. It's really nice to be able to discuss these sorts of things with you, Anthony, Kate and Danny, and see what happens. So as Penny said, I'm an archaeologist, and I'm trying to write about inequality together with an anthropologist called David Greber at the moment. And we originally conceived of the writing project as being a contribution to this burgeoning literature on inequality. You go to any high street bookshop, there's an extraordinary number of books about inequality from a huge number of different perspectives. And as we began to get into it, we began to feel sort of uneasy with this whole question of the origins of inequality. And actually, we've sort of come full circle to the realization that it's actually a very strange question to ask in the first place. And at some point, we found ourselves actually looking into the question of the origins of the question of the origins of social inequality, which are actually surprisingly complex and strange. We found this PhD by two Italian scholars who actually systematically went through and checked how often the words inequality or equality were used, for example, in the late Middle Ages. So this would have been the Latin equivalents and then their various European cognates at the time. And they were hardly used at all, and they were virtually never used to talk about relations between people. So the question then arises, you know, at what point did it become sensible or reasonable to ask what are the origins of inequality? And it's clear that by the late 18th century, so the later part of the European Enlightenment, everybody, more or less, who was anybody in terms of philosophy, had their own take on this question. And you get an extraordinary range of different answers to it. But by that time, everybody seems to assume that it is, in fact, a perfectly reasonable sort of question to ask. So one of the things we've been interested in is how did this actually happen? And by, I think it's 1754, the Dijon Academy of Sciences announces its essay competition. And the challenge is rather almost word for word your question, actually. What are the, write me an essay, what are the origins and causes of inequality, and is it a natural state for human beings to live in? This is the essay competition that Jean-Jacques Rousseau didn't win. People don't know this, but actually he came second. And what we now call the famous second discourse was the loser. In fact, it was disqualified because it was over the word limit. The judges actually refused to read it. Nobody's heard of the guy who actually won. But Rousseau came second. But Rousseau, of course, is the one that everybody now has read. One of the things we've been thinking about is to what extent that question, the origins of the question, was really formed by European encounters with the Americas and with the indigenous societies of the Americas, which increasingly we feel is a topic that's been rather sidelined, either on the basis that when Europeans write about indigenous peoples, they're sort of making it all up or romanticizing it beyond the pale of history, or just using fictitious indigenous characters as kind of sock puppets for their own opinions. It's a huge amount of evidence that this really isn't the case. What seems to have happened, particularly in the late 17th century, when you have really very, very detailed volumes coming back to Europe, particularly by Jesuit preachers. I mean, every sort of literate, vaguely aspirational middle-class person in a European salon would have the Jesuit relations on their shelves. And they give these very detailed accounts of how ridiculous and absurd many of the indigenous peoples of what's now Canada found Europeans to be, precisely on this question of inequality. But what they found odd, and remember that certainly, you know, at least some indigenous American statesmen usually did actually come to Europe. I mean, they went to Paris, like Wendat statesman Cunier, they came to Europe and they saw the parlous state of European cities, the condition of the working classes and the extent of homelessness and poverty. This new people are really weird. And what is it with you guys, us guys, this obsession with money? Why do you measure each other in terms of money? And these are the groups, of course, which, you know, today in the historical literature and the anthropological literature are described as egalitarian. But they're not egalitarian in the sense that everybody was the same or everybody had the same amount of wealth. Actually, what comes across very clearly in these accounts is that they're quite relaxed about wealth inequalities. There are wealth inequalities in many of these egalitarian societies. People have different amounts of stuff. But what they fail to grasp about European civilization is that people who have more stuff than other people also get these other kinds of extraordinary powers over them. And what bothered them so much about this was not so much the fact of material inequality as the idea that because you have more of something, you could also have sort of arbitrary authority over somebody else, or tell somebody else that basically they're not important, they have to do what you say. And this comes up time and time again in these Jesuit accounts. I mean, I can read you a very brief example of this sort of thing. And so this is from the 1642. This is a Jesuit priest called Father Lejeune, writing about the Montagne Naskapi people. He says they imagine they ought, by right of birth, to enjoy the liberty of wild ass colts, rendering no homage to anyone whatsoever, except when they like. They reproached me 1,000 times because we fear our captains. Captain seems to have been a generic word for anyone with any kind of authority. They reproached me 100 times because we fear our captains, while they laugh and make sport of their captains. All the authority of their chief is in his tongue's end, for he is powerful only in so far as he is eloquent. And these critiques are circulating very widely in the salons of Europe at that time. And by the late 18th century, people like Turgot are realizing that they're really quite subversive. And nobody's going to remember, we're only a few decades before the French Revolution here, nobody's going to come out and say, I'm not in favor of freedom. So the way that they seem to cope with this is to say, well, you can have that. You can have your liberty, but you can only have it if you're in this particular stage of material existence called hunting and gathering. Never mind that most of these people weren't actually hunters and gatherers, or they were people who used to be farmers and then got horses and started hunting again. They sort of brushed all that aside. So, well, you can have liberty, but only in this particular stage of sort of barbarism and savagery, which, you know, of course, was also used to appropriate native lands. And it's from that point on, it seems, that we begin to get this other story, which I think is still very much the story we're stuck with. That what we talk about as egalitarianism or equality, in any real sort of meaningful sense, is something which is supposed to be relegated to the bottom rung of this kind of ladder of progress. And that really what happened in human history is that with the origins of farming, one had private property, and with cities, inevitably, we were sort of doomed. doomed to live in this sort of state of radical inequality, and that if you really want to make society more equal, you're going to somehow have to eliminate 90% of the world's population, have mass industrial collapse, and go back to the dreams. Now, there are two sort of aspects of this as an archaeologist that I'm interested in, and then I'll maybe stop. I don't know how long you... one aspect is that the whole story is wrong. It's just factually incorrect. So partly the book I'm writing with David at the moment is really just trying to bring together a lot of the findings of archaeology over the last 30 or 40 years, which are buried in all these tiny specialist journals that hardly anybody reads, to really make the point that none of this is actually true. I mean, the whole story of human history really goes against these kind of ideas that I've been talking about. And the other thing we're interested in is to think about what the effect is of those kind of myths on the way people think about inequality today, which politically I think one could argue has been quite disastrous and deflating, in the sense that they set the bar so high for anything like an egalitarian approach to society. So what we're supposed to have in mind when we talk about egalitarian societies are these tiny bands of hunter-gatherers. I mean, as far as Rousseau was concerned, they weren't even bands, they were just these kind of solitary creatures moping around the landscape, no property whatsoever. Or we get, you know, ethnographic accounts of groups that do really exist. They are real groups, like the Hadza in Tanzania, who are certainly egalitarian to the point that, you know, if anybody wants to keep something, they're immediately vilified. And, you know, that is a very high bar to set for egalitarianism. And partly what we're trying to do is write about all of the other examples of moves in the direction of egalitarianism throughout human history. For example, the fact that actually many of the world's first known cities were strikingly egalitarian. Very few of them had monarchs, for example, of any sort. But a lot of this seems to get written out of the narrative when people write sort of big history books. You're still very much presented with that kind of Enlightenment story about the ambivalent nature of progress, and that as we became big societies, complex societies, inevitably we had to sacrifice so many of our freedoms that all we can do these days is just basically sort of tinker around the edges and play around with tax reforms and student fees, and, you know, maybe we can just make it slightly better. But the idea that one might actually change society in some more significant way is basically off the table, according to what I take to be the standard narrative. And it's that standard narrative that I'm interested in questioning.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, moving on to Kate.
That was so fascinating, and it probably means that some of what I'm going to say is going to come across as very naive. Never mind. So I'm an epidemiologist, as is Richard Wilkinson, my co-author and colleague, who's actually here tonight as well. And we've been interested in the contemporary impact of inequality on population health and societal well-being. And we've written a lot about how population health is worse in more unequal societies. You know, life expectancy is shorter, infant mortality is higher. We've written about how it affects children's life chances, and also about how it affects relationships within society and our participation in society, things like levels of trust and violence. But in our recent book, The Inner Level, we're writing much more about the impact on us psychologically. And really, I'm covering a threefold response to inequality. So some people in more unequal societies respond to that heightened salience of status by becoming depressed or anxious, going under, as it will, sort of withdrawing from the fray. Others respond by becoming more self-aggrandizing, narcissistic, self-enhancing. Trump is a good example of this, the rise of narcissism in American society as we've seen inequality increase. And then, of course, another way that some people respond is to compensate for their anxieties about inequality and their own status in society through things like alcohol, drug use, overeating, consumerism, status consumption. And that sort of withdrawal from social contact, with those anxieties about status and how we're seen in other people's eyes, made us sort of really start to question why we're so sensitive to social status. Why is it that our experience of ourselves through other people's eyes matters to us so much? And it was Charles Cooley, the American psychologist, who described our looking glass selves, that we experience ourselves primarily through the ways in which we feel other people respond to us. So that led us, I think, really to looking at the work of Robin Dunbar at Oxford, who's shown that our brains are basically a social organ. So our brain growth, you know, is driven by the size of our neocortex. It's huge in humans. And the size of the neocortex is related to the size of social groups in different monkeys and apes. And quite clearly, that part of the brain has evolved with the need to cope with social relationships. And relationships within groups can either be competitive or they can be collaborative. And so we were sort of trying to think about the history of inequality, or indeed the prehistory of inequality, and even the pre-human aspects of inequality, and trying to understand why are those social relationships so important? And of course it's because within any one species we're competing for the same resources, we have the same needs, whether it's food, nesting sites, sexual partners. But unlike other animals, we can actually cooperate in profound ways that other animals can't. So as well as competing for resources, we can actually collaborate. We can be assertively egalitarian if we want to be. We can share resources. We can have social bonds that enable more people to have more. Now, your recent work is probably going to make my following statement completely wrong, but we sort of were thinking about the evolutionary psychology of inequality in terms of a pre-human evolution within dominance hierarchies, a very long period of more egalitarian existence in hunter-gatherer, loosely termed, bands. And that 95% of our human history takes place in that period, and then seeing a rise in inequality with agriculture. Now.
Yes.
Yes. That's sort of the dominant narrative. But I think whether it's right or wrong doesn't really matter, actually, because I think from our point of view, that's sort of a red herring of whether it's a little bit more patchy or complex. Because what it does show, I think, is that we do know that some societies have been more egalitarian than others, and therefore we are capable, as human beings, of developing and living in reciprocal, caring, sharing societies. We don't have to be nasty and competitive and individualistic and out for ourselves, just trying to grab as much as we can. And that's the myth I think we're trying to bust. The myth that you can't tackle inequality because it's just human nature. And we hear that all the time. It's predominantly a right-wing political narrative, but it's also just a widely held public opinion. So if you talk to people and say, well, we work on inequality and we're trying to think of solutions to it, well, you can't do anything about it because it's just human nature. And so I think the notion that actually we have very flexible human natures, we're quite good at being nasty and competitive and out for ourselves and individualistic, but we're also equally good at being caring and sharing and egalitarian. And what structural and material inequality in society seems to do is to shape how much we respond in one way versus the other. And so I think you were talking about sort of the Enlightenment story of inequality. I think what we're experiencing at the moment is a result of the neoliberal story of inequality. The idea that human nature is competitive, the idea that what makes people happy is to have more stuff. And we're suffering the consequences of a modern rise in inequality that was driven by that neoliberal ideology as well as the policies that evolved from it. So if we look at inequality in the more recent historical time period, across the 20th century up to the present day, we see it very high in the early part of the 20th century in most developed Western nations, and then coming down quite dramatically from 1930s, late 30s on, or maybe even 20s, Danny will know this better than me. And then a modern rise from 1979-1980 onwards. And that, I think, also helps with this story about the flexibility of our societies as well as our human nature, because we used to be more equal as a nation, so we could be again. You know, the inequality of the UK isn't a fixed characteristic of our island natures. You know, we used to be, and indeed the USA used to be, as equal in the 1970s as Sweden is now. So we could be again, and I think that's a sort of optimistic idea. And sometimes you talk to people about promoting greater equality, and they say, well, we don't want to be like Scandinavians, you know, because they're all miserable. They're not, actually. They're happier than everybody else. But that's a bit of a red herring, too, because we don't need to be exactly like Finland or Sweden or Norway. We could be a more equal UK. So I think that historical pattern is an important response as well to busting the myth that we can't tackle inequality, because it's either a too rigid a part of our human nature, or it's too deeply a part of our human culture, and it's neither. It's a result of our current level of inequality. Our position as the most unequal country in Western Europe is a result of quite recent and quite obvious political and policy decision making. David mentioned how strange Native American populations found it that stuff mattered to us so much, you know, having more stuff. And I think it's really important to recognise that inequality isn't just about poverty. It's not just about not having material things. It's about social status. It's about relationships between people. It's about respect and self-respect and how we view one another. But the experience of poverty seems to be the same across the world in places with very different levels of material resources. If you are poor in India, you probably don't have clean water or sanitation or decent housing or enough to eat. If you're poor in Norway, you probably have quite a nice flat, you have various benefits, you have proper furnishings, you know, you have good material standard of living. But the experience of poverty in those two places is exactly the same. People feel shame, they feel humiliated, they feel they've worked really hard to try and escape their poverty, but they've not been able to do so. They feel like they've let down their families. The experience is the same. So there's a universal experience of being at the bottom of a social ladder that is about how people experience themselves through other people's eyes and about knowing their place in society. And then that matters all the way up. So the inequality, what it does is it makes the social ladder steeper, the rungs further apart, the social distances between us greater, And so we all experience those negative impacts of having to worry about our status, about it being more salient in a more unequal society. Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. I sound as if I'm about to cry. So the myth that we can't tackle inequality because it's a result of our fixed human nature, and the myth that certain cultures are just like that and can't do anything about it, are things that we need to sort of tackle full on, I think, if we're going to be able to have those radical conversations that David was suggesting about a reimagining of our societies in a more equal and egalitarian fashion.
Thank you very much, Kate. And then over to Daddy for the final talk.
Okay. Put the sound down, that's better. I'm going to kind of give you the Guardian newspaper and Wikipedia view of what archaeology tells us about inequality, which is probably the one you share, to try to provoke our archaeologists a bit. But I'll explain why. If you ever first meet Richard Wilkinson, who's at the front, the first question he asks you repeatedly until he gets an answer is, why are you bothered about inequality? I don't think I actually told him the truthful answer when he did this many years ago to me, but I've seen him do it to other people. The reason I'm bothered about inequality is I think I happen to grow up in a family where two of my brothers were adopted. So there are at least six sets of genes, possibly more. If you think about your families, you may underestimate the number that are actually involved. In my own family. And I didn't see us as that different, despite that genetic difference within the family. And I was lucky. I went to a school which was a remarkably equal school in my city, or equal in terms of its position in the country and the city, but a wide range of children went to that school, and they were all clever and they were all stupid. And then I entered a different society when I went to university, which really believed in inequality, really believed in hierarchy. And I now work at the University of Oxford, who's the very blood of the place, is that there are some of you, just a few of you, who are special, and our job is to go out and find you, a bit like the next Dalai Lama, and we will bring the golden children in and we will teach them how to rule the world, and then they too can put themselves forward on a list of candidates to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. Amazingly, just very recently, the number of people who admit to taking drugs has just exceeded the number of candidates with PPE. But there's still a lot in the... Anyway, so you've got an idea about why I'm bothered. Then you have a great fear when you're bothered that you try to shape all the evidence to fit your beliefs. And we know this. So the kind of thing that I've done is look through... I've drawn maps of the largest 32 world religions and then look through the originating myths or truth of each religion, and every religion, with the large ones, you find something about equality and inequality towards the beginning. Camels are the needle. You know, the Buddha, rich boy, didn't think that things were going the way they should, and so on. And it's a kind of common trope, if you're looking for that. I think you mentioned 1641 or 1642 in a quote, because my favourite quote about when we started worrying about this was almost the same year as René Descartes on the dockside in Amsterdam. The quote is, all about me is madness. Everybody here is simply believing in money, doing everything money, but at least they leave me free to think. I think he's writing a letter to Voltaire or something. So something about the 1620s, 30s, 1640s, way before any revolution was a time, and 1492, Karl Marx traces 1492 as when the thing began to change. But then what we do is we go back and we use all kinds of examples. So from our past in the 1970s when we were even to Sweden, what's happening in other countries now, and but also looking back at the past. So I'm just going to read you out because some of the pronunciation is hard. And the other reason why I'm doing this is I did a talk last night, and numerous times recently young folk have their notes on their phone, and I'm really impressed, but my eyesight's not good enough. So this is my large phone. And I'm going to give you the recent Guardian newspaper report from archaeologists. So, August last year, US-based archaeologists near Lake Turkana in Kenya discovered graves 5,000 year old, from which they concluded, somehow, that people shared work clothes without social hierarchy successfully generation after generation for centuries. That's 5,000 years ago. 4,000 years ago, people who later became to be known as the ancient Indus civilization in what's now India built cities without great social hierarchies, more Masaraka, well-planned wide public streets, both public and private drains, bathing places, aquifers and so on, communal reservoirs. Until the 1920s, we had no idea about this. More equal civilizations don't leave big monuments. Tend not to. Really unequal ones do. Pyramids are about inequality. So at school I was taught it was the Romans who did this first, but it turns out not. Assembly-based democracies have been traced back to what's now Syria, Iraq and Iran in India in the early Vedic period, where republics became common, where people recognised, and this is a quote from the book, this comes from, although people were not angels or gods or goddesses, they were at least good enough to prevent somebody else from thinking that they were. Democracy was to be governed by the humble, for the humble, and so on. And these ideas travelled to Phoenician cities and to Sidon and eventually got to Athens. And because Athens is almost Europe, that's the one we pick. We couldn't, I mean, it's amazing actually when you think about it, that there wasn't somewhere a bit nearer, which would have been a bit preferable for us to base our own myth about where we come from. Wikipedia, if you bear with me, Wikipedia, you know, of course academics use Wikipedia. It's a hell of a shock when you turn up in China and find you don't have any access to Wikipedia and you're supposed to be clever. It really is difficult. And the main thing about Wikipedia is that you can look at the page edits because it's being edited by academics as well. So the page edits on the most ancient democracy page used to say the oldest known existence of a democratic kingdom, Ganyanja, where the king was chosen by people's votes, can be traced back to exactly 599 BC. It's spelled V-A-J-J-I, I won't try and pronounce it, in ancient India. The birthplace of the 24th and last Vikarna of Jainism. That's been edited out as of last year. And now there's a really, really long, convoluted description with academics furiously hiding behind pseudonyms as they edit the Wikipedia page, arguing that it's all much more complicated than that. Zoom forward. Australia is the longest period of people appearing to live with a fairly high degree of some kind of equality, but definitely 3,000 years ago, 2,000 after the socialists of Lake Turkana were at work, an archaeologist, or at least have a Guardian report them, claims that the ancient stone dwelling suggested there was little in the way of social hierarchy. War was rare apparently, because without elites, who is there to order you to fight a war? Coming forward, China, lots and lots of work about the Great Northern Plain in China, and this is work from over 100 years ago, how 100 generations managed to live sustainably on the soil, partly using the night soil to replace it, and so on. So that's kind of partly in the way of provocation, because what people like me do is we pick and choose the things that fit what we want, the kind of they were more in the past. We kind of willingly ignore, I tend to, the amazing numbers of holes in people's skulls in the past. There's a terrible worry about, you know, were we just incredibly violent, or is it just that those are the ones that are put in special graves? I don't know. And the last thing I wanted to say was about wealth. Wealth and income, wealth and power. Because I think this is the crux of a lot of it. There's these incredibly strong correlations between income, equality and social harms. and even just between the income inequality of the top 1%. Well, to put it really bluntly, as long as you control the top 1%, say in Japan, and they're taking a small amount, everything else seems to work. There are very weak correlations with wealth inequality. Scandinavian countries can have very, very high levels of wealth inequality, not income, but wealth, and it doesn't seem to matter. But it's a different kind of power. It's a little bit like Scotland, where the wealthy may own the land, but you have a right to camp on it and walk over it. The kind of equality I'd like to see us moving towards, I live in Oxford. I like getting in a canoe and going up the River Charwell. I am blocked by the workers of the Branson estate. Richard Branson doesn't just live on a small island he owns, thanks to all of you using Virgin Mail and paying for it. He has an estate next to the Rothschild estate. The whole of Oxfordshire is full of these estates. And his workers cut trees and put them across the river to stop you being able to canoe past his property. So you take a saw. And to be really effective, you take a saw and 20 children. Because they love sawing through trees. There are 2,000 lakes in Oxfordshire, by the way, all of which are private. All of which, of course, you can just swim in. And the correct answer to the standard question when you are swimming in the lake is, from the owner, when they turn up, is, can I help you? And the correct answer is, no, I'm perfectly fine in your lake. I won't go on. I can. I have no problem with Richard Branson and the Rothschilds continuing to own their estate. In fact, I want them to continue to own their estate. I just simply want the laws changed. And we did this with the right to vote on. So that they have a responsibility to ensure that the path that they have to build over that estate and the clearing of the river is done so well that it is perfectly safe for me and my family to walk over all their land. They can have the wealth, they can own the land, I want to walk over it. It's as simple as that. And that is, if you like, income and power equality. And just as when you look at Scandinavia, you see that some families have a lot of wealth, they're not using that wealth excessively. They're not using it to control newspapers. They're not allowed to. And the income differences between people, which are crucial, because income is how we respect each other. You know exactly how you're respected in this society. It is exactly in proportion to the amount of money you're paid or get as a pension or receive in your household group. You know exactly how much you respect other people where you work, because you tell those people by how much you pay them. That's how we do it, which is why income really matters. Wealth is much less important as long as the wealthy are given obligations to do. Tony Blair turned it around the wrong way. He said something about, was it responsibility and duties or rights? I've forgotten which way. But Tawney said it first. And that with great wealth comes responsibility and things you should be obliged to do. And I think that's partly how we begin to sort things out. But I do worry, I've deliberately given you my kind of course history, because people like me and Kate, that is what we are looking for. We know that whenever you're an academic, you want to say things are much more complicated. Of course you do, because you can't spend 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day working on something. But I want the short answer. You know, essentially, when they say that many cities in the past do appear to be more equal, when people say that from the relics we find, we think that times people live for generation after generation without great differences between each other, is that essentially true? Because we want to know in our hearts of hearts, is it possible? Because if you know it is possible, it's much easier trying to make it possible than if these have just been cherry picked because they happen to fit the kind of thing we'd like to hear at the moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Great. Thank you for some great provocation there from all of our speakers. So now what we'd like to do is turn over to you and open up the floor for questions. While you have a think about questions, I have a question that I'd like to pose the panel first. Do you think that inequality today is greater than it ever has been?
No. No, I don't. In most Western sort of developed market democracies, we are back to levels of inequality that we haven't seen for quite a long time. But that we don't know enough, I think, about previous levels of inequality to be certain. It depends whether you mean us in the UK or the world in general.
Well, let's start with us in the UK.
I can have a go if you like.
Well, go on.
Go on, I'd love it. I think we were most unequal around about 1913. Some people argue there was a time earlier when we were more. This is income. The extreme, a bit later, 1921. How many of you read or know of Whitehead Who Visited?
Yes.
Okay, Sebastian's mum. She was part of the 0.01%, those really rich families. Her income, based on the investments were in the empire, her income was three times higher than the income of that same group today, the ones who are in the Sunday Times wish list. So we have been more unequal. It was a time of the great country houses where the largest occupational group for women was to be a servant. To work in service. And that went from that enormous 300 times. So she had 300 times the average income purely from investments. She worried about what the servants might hear her say. She would never imagine working. To by 1942, dropping to what the wealthy today have. So it's an incredible fall. But
remember, there are as many maids in Mayfair now as there were during the Victorian era.
In Mayfair.
In Mayfair.
But not in York.
Not in York.
With that, I would like to open the floor for questions.
Well, it's just a little bit of an observation. I mean,
if you could just wait for the microphone so that people can hear. Thank you.
I think that the speech from York University was made a comment about poverty, a comparative comment about poverty in India, which was generalised right across the whole of the Indian subcontinent. So, a comment about poverty that was that broad and compared that in some kind of direct way with the experience of poverty in Britain. I just struggled with the lack of a cultural dimension to that and a philosophical dimension to that, because people's experience of inequality is massively affected by their social and philosophical and cultural identity and perspectives and beliefs. So having no reference to that, the statement seems to be meaningless to me. Because how people experience poverty is all over the world, including this country, is massively affected by the cultural and philosophical beliefs.
That doesn't seem to be what the empirical evidence suggests. So the example I was giving of India in comparison to Norway were just two of the countries included in a comparative sociological study of the lived experience of poverty in lots of different countries, some wealthier countries, some middle income, and some developing countries. And of course, all of those places have different cultures, different senses of identity. There may even be different societal attitudes towards the tolerance of inequality and that kind of thing. But what surprised the researchers doing this work was the consistency across cultures and across identities in the experience of the shame of being at the bottom of society. So it didn't seem to be affected by the things you're mentioning. It seemed to be consistent in all of those different places. Can you remember the reference, Richard? What's his name?
I was trying to remember whether his name was Rogers or Richards or
Robin, something. I'll try and remember it for you by the end of this.
But it's interviews by an international team of people in poverty in about six different countries at different stages of development.
He was the Professor of Social Policy at Oxford, his lead author, and he's got a very forgettable name. Very nice man, very forgettable name. Yeah, I can't remember. But it was a really big study. The reason they published it is a surprise. India was the only really... Was Uganda as well?
No, they had Pakistan and Uganda.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it was a surprise. So an equivalent one would be a study of that was done about how people dealt with the deaths of children in the past. And you've got to remember, the majority of adults saw their children, or at least their child, die. And so what you might expect is that they were a bit more robust, because it's happening everywhere. Whereas, you know, there'll be some poor sort of here that will have experienced this. It's the worst thing you can imagine. Now that study that I saw about experiencing the deaths of children actually found that people in the past appear to be just as devastated, even though it's common, but a very different context. Shakespeare's the one who's often used, and how he changed what he wrote after his children died. We jump on the surprising things. You sort of think that can't make sense.
Well, I think they're two very different things that you're talking about. I think they're very different. Children dying and relative concepts of poverty are profoundly different human experiences.
But we find that shame is a very common human experience, and everywhere it's the shame effect. Is a thing more common than we had assumed. And you'd thought in India, of all places, where people are told by particular religions that you're there and you're high up, and as long as you're really, really well behaved, you will go on to another life. So why worry about your position in this one?
The psychologist Thomas Schaff calls shame the social emotion, you know, the most important social emotion that shapes us the most in our sort of thinking and our behaviours and our relationships.
So there are a couple of questions in the middle that can get a microphone.
Hi, I'm a historian and I quite like my terms to be defined, and I feel like we've launched into this discussion of inequality, and I don't know that there's been a clear stance on what equality actually means to each of the panellists. And I think there's been a discussion as well of how different cultures interpret inequality, and I feel like there are different understandings of what equality means and whether or not inequality and equality actually matter. And there's always been this kind of definition in opposition, and you know, from going back to post-Roman societies and how they define themselves in relation to the post-Roman Empire, but bringing it back into the modern day, I feel like there are different levels of tolerance of inequality, and I just wondered what each of you actually defined inequality as being.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly the right question to ask, because these are incredibly vague terms, and they're often used in really completely contradictory ways without people really defining what they're talking about. I mean, equality could mean all sorts of things. So can egalitarianism. Are you talking about people all being the same? Are you talking about a society in which everybody has the right to assert their particular individual capacities to the maximum without being criticised? I mean, these would be two very different looking kinds of moral, social, ethical systems, but you could call them both equal in a certain way. I can't give you a definitive definition, because I think any attempt to do that is really oversimplifying what are in reality really inescapably complex issues, because people are not the same. I mean, just look around. If your idea of equality is you know, making people the same, and I think this is an important mismatch between the you know, the sort of statistical grand statements around, oh, the 1% control half of the world's wealth, and this is supposed to be some great challenge to the global order when you say these sort of things. You know, what then is the response? If you're fighting against is inequality, what is your more equal society supposed to actually look like? Where are these ideas going to actually come from? I mean, if you have something that you can really sort of get your teeth into, say, well, let's rail against the class system, let's go up against the racists, let's tackle gender equality. These are real things. We know, we can recognise them when we see them. When you say let's fight inequality, I'm never quite sure what it is that people think they're sort of aiming for. So I share with, I forget who it was, The Nation, a few months ago, somebody published a nice editorial called The Inequality Industry, which was about the, oddly enough, the sort of attractiveness of inequality as a concept to people who are really very heavily invested in maintaining the status quo. So this is sort of Oxfam going to Davos sort of phenomenon. And I thought that was a very interesting piece. And I do think it comes back to this question of do we really mean it when we say change?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we're at a very early stage with work on inequality. If you think about sort of liberty, fraternity, equality, we've had an organisation promoting liberty in this country called Liberty for a very long time. Equality is rather new. My personal definition is income, as I sort of made clear to you. And it's about food. It's got to give us this day our daily bread. The problem is, if you get diverted to other things which all matter, you go off the most keen one. I think the stage we're in with inequality is similar to the suffragettes at the point where people insulted them by calling them suffragettes. Turns out they were actually right and it did matter, but they were finding it hard to explain why it mattered, and they just looked like a set of posh women who wanted to do something different. So to give you a concrete example from last week or the week before, the day after the special rapporteur of the UN named the two schools in Oxford, Orchard Meadows and Pegasus School, where the dinner ladies were going to the food bank to get enough food so the school could honour its statutory requirement to give the free school meals to the kids. This is in Oxford. I sat in the governing body of my college, in which I had to listen for 40 minutes while my colleagues discussed the problem that some of our undergraduates were not coming to the feast, which was free, and 20 of them hadn't turned up. And I got a bit irate, but not too irate, because I've got used to this. But I did mention it to a senior person later, who said, oh yes, this is awful. We're trying to make sure we scrape the spare food into a bucket, because we could send that to the primary school down the road. And it kind of fits you, because you're right, people have different perceptions of, and this is a more liberal colleague. So this is where I work. I mean, there are lots of nice people there, but honestly, this is the kind of thing that happens regularly. And it can only happen because of our level of inequality and how we tolerate it. Right? You would think it's... the obvious thing to do, we're an educational charity, obviously there's only two bloody primary schools, so they can't feed the kids. You know, £5,000 a year would solve it. And do we really have to feed our own anyway? But so I can be blunt, my definition is at the moment it's income and it's about daily bread. We know that 3% of adults in this country are seriously starving. Think about it. There are so many university researchers producing such good work at the moment, you know, trying to get it really accurate. Is it 2%? Is it 3%? Is it 4%? It's 3%. The number who are going seriously without food but not starving is much higher and rising rapidly. But it's the equivalent of our day, if I'm right, and I could be wrong, it's the equivalent of our day to that rise of women saying you need to take women seriously, give us a vote. And we're in that period, 20 or 30 years before you're getting anywhere, where people just said you're annoying. You know, can't you really concentrate on something properly serious like this war with France, whatever we were doing at the time, which seemed to be the thing that really mattered. that's I could be wrong. Yeah. And I think it, you can worry about racism in Oxford. We've got some. You know, we worry endlessly now about gender equality because that's okay to do. So I sit on thousands of meetings about the difference between men and women. The one thing we're not allowed to talk about is this income inequality. We can do some token letting in a few working class kids, so we do a little bit of talking about class, and we're all middle class, so it's all fine. But mentioning the fact that some of us are paid five times more than others, or trying to get your colleagues to pay the cleaner £10.02 an hour rather than £9.92, it's impossible.
Right? That I'm actually... I'm going to jump in, Danny.
Go on.
I'm really happy there's an inequality industry, if there is one. I'm really happy that Oxfam go to Davos. I'm really happy that there are bookshops full of books about inequality, because about 10 years ago, nobody talked about it. It was impossible to have political conversations about inequality. I once spoke at a conference in Scotland where a member of the Scottish Labour Party came up to me afterwards and said, I love this work, it's really important, I've been following Richard's work for years, and I naively said, oh great, what are you going to do about it? And he, you know, practically held up the garlic and the sort of little steak and said, oh no, no, we are not allowed to talk about inequality in New Labour. So that was probably about 12 years ago. So at least now we are having a conversation. If it needs to be a more complicated conversation, I'm fine with that. But at least we're starting to have the conversation. And when it comes to sort of ideas about how equal is good enough, or what do we know, the empirical evidence we have, looking at objective measures of people's health and their well-being, suggests that things get better in a pretty linear fashion as you go from the most unequal developed nations up to the most equal ones. Now, we don't have any societies that are more equal than the Scandinavian countries and Japan. So we don't know what would happen if a whole nation became even more equal than them. But with the empirical evidence we've got, it suggests that every little bit more equality of incomes that you manage to foster in some way, you will see the benefits of that written upon the physical and mental health of your population and the well-being of your society. Epidemiologists, we don't do philosophy much, you know, we like numbers, objectively measured data, and then we're quite happy to make sweeping conclusions.
Oh, we're enjoying your sweeping conclusions, thank you, Kate. No, sorry, there's a question there.
Thank you. I thought the point that was made about how we couldn't have discussions about inequality until quite recently is quite interesting. And I think one of the things that... So I'm a second-year university student here. I am part of a generation where everything that we think about to do with inequality, to do with identity politics, a lot of it is shaped by the aftermath of the financial crash in 2008. That's what I remember as like being a really significant event. And I think a lot of other people are the same, and I think that is beginning to affect conversations around inequality. And given the panel, there's been quite a lot of discussion about the role of income inequality, and there's a lot of discussion now about with ongoing events, the future of inequality. I was just wondering what the panel thought about how, like, inequality is also not just like not just social status as being something that is affected by income, but also by perspective and kind of like age, and being able to get onto these like kind of income levels and being able to get into it, which is like so much a concern, like inequality in all its forms is so much a concern of people at the moment. And I guess I was just wondering what, yeah, the panel thought about it.
Yeah,
intergenerational
inequality. I mean, it's really interesting. It's more of an issue now, because you're facing a future, if things carry on as they are, where you either get into the 10% and your chance is about 50-50 if you're a student at York on average, And if you're in the 10%, you'll be taking all 4/10 of everything. You won't be happy, but you won't be in the bottom 90, because we've become in the bottom 90% of society is living an Eastern European lifestyle and heading downwards. So you have to go to university, you have to get a degree, you have to go to London, you have to do the next stage, and you never know, you might, if you're really lucky and work really hard, but mainly you're really lucky, you might be able to one day get a mortgage and buy the kind of home you grew up in. Right? And that's partly why inequality affects university students now. If we could go back to when the University of York was formed, and we wouldn't be here, in the heady days of you work here, you know, the finish on the head. But anyway, probably late 60s, early 70s. Very different set of students to what we get now, produced by quite a different education system of people who had an idea that they were going in a different direction in future society. Undergraduates were not worried that much about what job they were going to go into because they were all fine, they were graduates. And some of them would think, I'm going to be a social worker, some would do other things. You wouldn't go into banking to make money, because bankers were paid less than doctors back then. And you didn't have a preoccupation with income and wealth inequality because it wasn't such an issue, because we were the second most equal country to Scandinavia. Whereas we've generated this situation in which if you don't fall your way over everybody else and get the high 2-1 or the first and then get mum and dad to pay for the master's degree, because that's the only way you can get one, and help get them to help you out with the rent for the flat in London, otherwise you can't work in that publishing job, which will give you the chance of the next thing. It's awful. But boy, is it good for universities, because everybody has to get a degree if you're middle class, if you can. So you like to be worried. But it's entirely solvable if we actually think of it as a bad thing. There are enough houses out there for everybody to be able to start a family. Back in the 1970s, people were starting their families in their 20s, because you could. And you could get a house and you got a job, which would last, particularly if you're male, has to be said, you get a job which you could stay in, and we had full employment, and we were more equal.
Oh, yeah, I wondered if you had anything to say about the history of intergenerational wealth, or to reflect on.
Well, I mean, listening to the question, and which I think is slightly broader, actually, than intergenerational wealth, although that was part of it, I worry slightly that, I mean, I wouldn't doubt for a moment the statistical evidence which shows what you say it shows. But I do worry whether there is an element of circularity in the assumption that because the statistics show that currently, in a majority of countries, income inequality is a very good predictor of all these other things, that is necessarily telling us anything fundamental about human nature, human cognition, or any of these other more basic sort of anthropological questions. I'm worried that maybe what it's telling us is that what is essentially a sort of ideology has become a global, or at least very epidemiologically successful sort of ideology. And the result of that ideology is that you now get people, including archaeologists, sort of pursuing this interest in income inequality further and further back. I mean, really back into incredibly early periods when we don't know a bloody thing about this sort of thing. But you still get people trying to do it, and even using sort of, I'm not sure, is it pronounced Gini or Gini coefficient?
Gini coefficient. Mm.
Thank you. Gini coefficients. I've seen Gini coefficients for the Stone Age. Mm. Isn't that fantastic? 0.25 for the average Stone Age hunter-gatherer.
It's really low.
It's extraordinarily low because, you know, they're basically doing the Rousseau thing where they say, well, the Stone Age hunter-gatherer is a person who's basically got nothing because there's nothing to have. Mm. So there's no surplus for anyone to grab, so there's no inequality. Mm. Now, I even saw one study where they figured out the daily earning of a Paleolithic hunter-gatherer. Would you like to guess?
daily earning equivalent to...
It was in dollars.
$2 a day.
$1.20.
That's exactly what it was. that's remarkable. It was actually $1.20 a day. Now, you've got to ask yourself, how do you end up with a figure like that? And we looked into it, actually. We found a study where they got this from. And it seemed like what they would do was trying to figure out how much food they were eating. But of course, you know, you only have to reflect on this for a moment to realise how bloody silly it is. Yeah. Because I made a list, actually, of all the things they weren't counting, which we get, which we have to pay for, which in the Stone Age you got for free, like care of the elderly, or entertainment, or divorce resolutions, or, you know, the food they're eating is presumably 100% free-range organic. I mean, that must be camping sites on the Dordogne, cake painting lessons, wearing fur coats, I mean, all this sort of thing. You're way over $1 a day. You know, there's a reason Marshall Islands called them the original affluent society. So I think this sort of slight obsession with income inequality is sort of this trans-historical thing leads to conclusions which are at best trivial and sometimes just a bit silly.
No, I agree, they can go wrong.
I'm going to disagree.
Well, just go back to 1913. A book called Lark Flies to Cannelford about a village in Oxfordshire where they were dirt poor, but they had food because they were all growing food. Income's acutely important now because you cannot get... The middle class have got all the allotments.
They certainly have in York.
In York, yeah. And the potato harvest failed last year, which is why we can't leave Europe, but anyway. We'll get on to that. But yeah, I would love to know the period within which actually having cash becomes absolutely essential and where. There's times in Russia where if you were in rural parts of Russia after 89, you were much better off than if you were in Moscow. Because again, you can actually get access to food. But food nowadays includes access to bins you can go into. And if there are too many people and children in the trying to actually bin dive to get the wasted food. That's much more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's good we're asking these questions of the historical and prehistorical record. So, you know, our evidence is statistical epidemiological evidence, which we can put in a causal framework and be pretty sure it's really robust that we are seeing the impact of inequality in terms of health and other things, and be sure what's sort of driving that. And then that, if you want to explain that, if you want to understand why that relationship occurs, then you have to sort of get into the biology of chronic stress. And when you get into the biology of chronic stress, then you actually have to understand the neuropsychology of chronic stress. And when you start to get into the neuropsychology, then you have to start thinking about how that neuropsychology evolved. And that means, I think, we do need to ask the kinds of questions of our historical and prehistorical data that allow us to think about our evolved psychology and how it may be leverage for us optimising population well-being. On your question about young people, I think we all sitting here probably would agree that young people today in the UK, it's a much tougher world than the one we grew up in. It's almost a sort of perfect storm of inequality, financial crisis, austerity, but social media too, and other ways in which one's status is so much more exposed to the eyes of the world than ours ever was when we were growing up, and the notion that you have to kind of curate that image for other people, I think, is incredibly stressful. We don't have good data on that sort of internationally. but I think there are a range of issues facing your generation that are much tougher than what we have to tackle.
There is someone who's been desperate to ask a question in the white shirt at the back. It's had a hand up for a long time, and I said...
Thank you. So one of the key things is this all right, is it? Yeah?
That's fine.
That's fine. It's just my mind. Is that you've talked quite a lot about income and wealth inequality, but there's a common theme about power. And for me, the point around why should you be more powerful because you have more stuff is such a fundamental kind of question. So what I was wondering is whether that's the relationship that we have to break.
I mean, I don't care how much money Aaron Banks has got, but I care about the fact that he can use it in certain ways to influence it.
Well, then, but I was going to turn the other way and say that, well, we're bound to touch on Brexit anyway, weren't we? But is populism, is the positive side of populism actually people taking power back? And do we have to go through populism to get to an egalitarian society?
Well, historically, certainly no, we don't have to go through populism to have more equality in various times and places. We know from a recent study from management economists at the University of Chicago that we see more votes for right-wing populist parties in American and European elections in more equal countries in US states. So there is a link.
More unequal.
More unequal US states and more unequal European countries, you get more voting for right-wing populists. Don't think anybody's looked at other kinds of populism because maybe there aren't any parties running in those elections. But, I mean, income matters because of the stuff, and then it does matter because of power. It would be very difficult for me as an epidemiologist to find a measure of power to compare different countries and the amount of power and how power is distributed, really. And so what income can be is a very useful proxy for thinking about the hierarchy of power. But we also think it matters in itself because it is through what it purchases for us that we demonstrate our status. And so I do care how much he owns because actually how much he owns affects all of us.
But assuming that one's free to distribute and consume things, any way one likes, but this isn't the case in many countries.
Yeah. There are things where your consumption directly affects others. The classic is property. So in China, as far as I understand it, it is now not legal to own more than two residences. So if you're about to get married, you get, and you're well off, very well off, you get two, she gets two in my case. And between you've got four, but that's it. And one of the reasons why many very affluent people from China have been buying apartments in London is they're not allowed to buy a third or fourth in China. And the Chinese authorities don't worry about the effect this might have on London at all. They're stopping there being an issue in China by limiting. So and the same thing happens in Switzerland, where again they control the behaviour of some of the wealthy. When that behaviour directly affect other people. Ownership of newspapers and ownership of multiple amounts of property because it's finite. But also the message you send when you do that. But we used to directly relate voting to property. You had to be mayor, but you also had to have property. And then the amount of property reduced, a bit of property you were allowed to vote. You would get two votes if you were certain people in British society and not in others. It's only very recently, in the last less than 100 years, that the idea of one person, one vote has become normal. And there are people who want to take that away. And we partly take it away at the moment by making it hard for a whole set of people to register to vote. Usually, the people in the United States don't register and are not allowed to register because of felonies. And this country and all of Europe breaks the law by not letting people in prison vote, and we have the highest proportion of people in prison anywhere in Europe. And we could go backwards. It wouldn't be hard to do.
I mean, I think the question you ask is really fundamental, because you do have situations where there are high levels of inequality but very little freedom. And I was quite struck when Danny was talking about his Wikipedia troll. You mentioned a democratic kingdom, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, as far as I can tell.
Where the king's elected.
Yeah. Why do they call him the king, though? president or something. Mm. But it is about clarity of terms, actually. I'm still there. you know, talking about egalitarianism, equality, and then you throw democracy into the mix. Well, there's an interesting question. And you've talked about populism. I'm always struck, you know, by people discovering, you know, remarkable, we've discovered a democracy that wasn't ancient Greece, as if this was in any way surprising. You know, as my friend David always points out, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to get a bunch of people to stand on one side of the room if they agree with the proposition, and on the other side if they don't. You know, it didn't take an Aristotle or sort of one genius to say, if you like this idea, put your hand up. If you don't, put it down. And I'm not sure what the sense of astonishment is that we found a democracy somewhere. The weird thing is people seem to look for democracy in all the wrong places. They look for it in kingdoms or empires. Say, oh, look, the Mesopotamians, they had kings and emperors for thousands of years. But look, they also have popular assemblies in their cities. Isn't this an astonishing achievement, given that they weren't Greek? Whereas, in fact, you know, we're talking about very basic human things kids do in the playground quite spontaneously. So I think there has to be another question there about precisely power and how one reaches decisions. And I'm really struck by the recent popular movements calling for citizens' assemblies as a way of thinking through and tackling issues of climate change. Now, I think it's really important to know if people who are asking for that sort of representation are in fact going against the grain of evolutionary psychology. I mean, Robin Dunbar would presumably say, don't even bother, don't even get out of bed, because, you know, we've crossed all these thresholds that make it completely inconceivable that we would have that sort of participatory democracy on a large scale. Our brains would explode or something. You can only do that in a little group of hunter-gatherers, so don't even bother. Actually, at that point, I think it becomes very important to know what went on in cities through time, right from their inception. And does it actually tell a different story? I think it does, incidentally. But, you know, you're quite right. People very rarely try to bring this stuff together and look at it in a way that isn't simply serving an agenda, usually their own sort of personal one. So I think that I would inevitably defend my field and say that it does matter whether we get the story right, or at least as close to the evidence as we can stick it in terms of human history.
Okay, so there's a question in the middle here. Can wait for the microphone.
There's been quite a lot of discussion about income, so I'd just like to ask the panel what their thoughts are on universal basic income.
Okay, I'll start. I'm about to, I hope, develop a pilot trial of a universal basic income for young adults in Bradford. I've got the money to conduct the research, but I haven't yet got the money to make the universal basic income payments to £60 a week for 2 years. We'll get it, so I think it will happen. I think it's inevitable that we will move towards some kind of universal basic income. And I think it's important that we do so. But of course, it's not just one thing. There are lots of different sorts of flavours of it. There are lots of different ways you might think about how you pay for it. But basically, I'm in favour.
Okay, quickly. There are loads of experiments that are going on around the world at the moment. And we already have it for certain groups, and much of Europe has it for many more groups. So anybody who's a pensioner here has it. There's a limit, there's a bottom limit you can actually get as a basic income for pensioners. We used to have it for children until George Osborne took it away for the third or fourth children, because he has a particular psychotic tendency. and he only has two children called Luke and Lucky. But we are a long way along the line already. The great thing about universal basic income, you can start it off in numerous ways. Say €1,000 a year if you're a citizen or a resident of the European Union. And Gordon Brown paid for modelling to be done of that by Holly Sutherland. And that makes it much easier if you're on the edge of Europe not to move to Berlin to be a cleaner, because €1,000 goes much further on the edge than in the middle. Other suggestions are you bring it in for a particular generation to kind of say, sorry, you could be unlucky, because it'll actually be a set of 18-year-olds get it first. Among many of the other advantages of it, and you can bring it in very low and then raise it, we need to pay a lot of people to do very little consumption, because we need to consume less. And the best way to do that is to say, in effect, there is a fifth option. If you remember Blair saying, no more fifth option. You know, you can do this, this, and this, but you can't stay in the garage playing the guitar anymore. We need people sitting in their garages playing guitars, not flying on holiday anywhere, getting a very low amount of money, but enough you could eat. You know, honestly, we can't sort out eating. So I think it's on the way. Who does it first? How little successful they are? Which particular way of beginning to introduce it will be interesting. But it gets your consumption down. And it says, if you're willing not to consume very much and to wear all your clothes out and not to go on holiday, we're willing to pay you enough that you can survive, and we're not going to make you apply to 30 jobs a week and pretend you want them, and then have to take these terrible jobs and make sure you're sacked because you can't face it anymore. In the madness of, oh, we have the best, we have the best, highest numbers of people employed ever. Isn't that good? Not as much as the States, where people have 3 or 4 jobs a week. You know, we're heading towards that. Because your ideal society for work is one we've seen, which is one where there's actually more work than people. And if you don't like your job, you can tell your boss to stick it and walk off. That's how you get high quality jobs, that you can actually leave them. And we had it in the time of my parents. But it's how we get there will be interesting. Some people hate basic income because they hate the idea of people having freedom. And they also think we all need to work really, really hard, because Britain must be number one, because that really matters to them.
Yeah, boringly, I'm going to agree, and I think the kind of evidence that you're accumulating really goes to show that if you're right, then something like universal basic income ought to have an incredibly positive effect generally on society. So I'd be interested to hear what an objection to it might look like. But I'm afraid you're not going to get one from this panel.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. So there's a hand that's gone up at the back there. I think it's been up for quite a while.
Hello. I've got a few questions in mind, but I'll just go with one. Do you have any thoughts or agree on Parfit's idea that when we're actually talking about equality, what we really want is proletarianism?
Is what?
Proletarianism?
Prioritarianism. So that what we really want to do is lift the worst off and help them the most, because less resources have a greater effect in that area, and so that maybe what we're looking for is equality, but we want to help those who are based on society and live into a higher standard.
Well, it's a question that comes up a lot. Should we only be worried about raising the floor and improving the lot of people at the bottom? And, of course, perhaps that is easier for people to sort of accept and value rather than tackling inequality across the income distribution and worrying about the top, worrying about the 1% as well. But what the evidence shows is that we're all affected by inequality, not just the people at the bottom, they are affected the most, but we're all affected. So if I were to take Danny with his high level of education, enormous income, and high social class, and to drop him in Sweden or Norway or Finland or any of us, we would be more likely to live longer, our children do better in school, etc., etc. So a whole range of things would be better. So the inequality across the distribution matters, and that means we have to pay attention to the top as well as the bottom. So we do need to be thinking about lowering the ceiling as well as raising the floor.
I'll go next. I'm in a 3%. I'm always happy to declare this. I'm not really declaring very much because that is the published professorial salary range from the bottom to the top. All professors, apart from the LSE, where they pay higher, in the 3%. So we're bloody well off, but we moan because we find it hard to get a house, and some people find it hard to pay the school fees if they feel that they need to do that. And of course, if you're in the 3%, you're in a group where the majority of people do pay private school fees. People who are poor matter the most, and most average people matter the most, but I increasingly spend my time with very, very privileged people, and my personal greatest interest is in the effect of equality on people at the top. And a more equal society helps particularly young people realise that what they think of as a privileged education may not have been one. It's simply training you to get A stars in a particular inane kind of way of knowing how to write a 9-point question in geography, where if you actually wrote the correct answer you'd get a C, but if you write the answer that the examiner wants you'll get an A or an A star. And in a very unequal society like ours, if you're near the top, you must never have an honest relationship with your parents. You can't actually argue with them because you will be relying on that deposit for the house and the flat. And that's absolutely vital. I mean, you're only talking about a really crappy one-bed flat in Bethnal Green, but you need the £60,000 that they will give you when you're 25 for it. Who you can love or marry, you have to keep secret in our society. We're back to Lady Chatterley's lovers kind of time. The social uncomfortableness at Christmas, if you bring the wrong person back, it's fine if they, you know, you're a boy, they're a boy, that's okay. Or if they're black and you're white, that's okay. But if they're poor and you're rich, you know, you can get them to sign a prenup. But what kind of love is it when you get somebody to sign something for when you split up? So, and it's a very personal thing, and I can never get a publisher to let me write on this because the market's very small. I really think that there is a lot of damage at the top of society. I see third and fourth generation. So for the very wealthy, it's almost always the man who makes the money. And the man is often very, very odd and extremely driven and makes a billion. And there's a token wife, often, think Trump, but it's... second generation is slightly more normal, but still quite affected. Third generation, much more normal, but very affected by the fact that they've been so closeted by the family trust. Normally, in the past, the wealth would dissipate by the fifth or sixth generation. But now, some of these families... I won't go on about that, because people never say why. They've formed companies that stop them being able to drink the money away and gamble it, which if you look at the rich families of the past is how it went. I worry about people at the top. We looked in Sweden, which is one of the most equal countries, where we have to complete tax and income records as 20-year-olds. And 20-year-olds in their 20s, from 20 to 29, you are most likely to die if you're in the best off 10 for society. And what was happening, if you look at the causes of death, was cocaine, light aircraft, climbing accidents, and a bit of suicide. So it isn't necessarily advantageous to be well off. Or the last one to leave, if you're not believing me, the highest rate of taking of drugs, antidepressants, in Los Angeles is in Beverly Hills. Absolutely zonked out of their minds. And they give their pets the drugs. You've got these dogs on Prozac. And just look at the United States. Look at the top of the United States society. The Trumps are not exceptional for the kind of family you get there. And it isn't anything anybody should envy or want to ever be in. So I'm saying it's much bigger than lifting the poor. It's making sure that some little lad in their future doesn't have to be Baron Trump.
David, perhaps you'd like to...
Well, just briefly, I'm not familiar with, I think it was Parfit, I'm not familiar with that, but I'm a bit suspicious of any theory that is piecemeal in that way. I think it's artificial to think about one sector without taking into account the kind of structure that we're talking about. And I think what would be helpful around these sorts of issues is a lot more ambitious thinking and analysis of the structures of power and how those reproduce themselves, which includes financial inequality, but isn't just that. It's about dynasties, it's about monarchy, and it's about lots of other things as well.
Yeah. Nobody ever says that there are a few children in this country who've been born into a form of slavery where their whole future life is determined for them. Those are the children of our royal family.
Right.
They have almost no choice. The agency it would take, which Edward did before, but the agency to say, I don't want this. And it's whining, you know. Would you want to be born a prince or a princess and have the cameras on you for your entire life?
It's funny you say that. I was just watching the other day an interview with the actor Michael Caine. And because we're talking about social mobility, right? And it just struck me listening to him what a sort of limited and unimaginative notion of social mobility we usually sort of slip into, where you know, he was explaining to his generation. If you were born working class, you were effectively told that the purpose of your life was to serve those other people, the toffs. You were never going to be like them. You were never going to have any of what they had. And, you know, he was talking about the 60s and so on and how that all changed, but the net result of that is that he's become a cockney toff. And, you know, he does now have that, and he gets all those things, and he's got his flunkies that he can pay for. So he's gone up in that scale. But the scale is the same scale, and the attitudes are the same. So I wonder how much, you know, when we talk about social mobility, we're just not being very creative in a way.
Okay,
can I just add one thing?
Yes.
We've been talking a lot about the myths of what human nature is like and inequality. There's one other big myth that is relevant, and that is that people end up at the bottom of society because they're stupid or they're lazy. And that's another one we'll have to tackle on another night. But we now have somebody who may be our next Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who has described society as being like a cornflake packet. You give it a good shake and some of the cornflakes rise to the top, and they're the clever ones and the hard workers, and they should be rewarded.
And today or yesterday, his big policy is, vote for me, I'll increase inequality. Yeah. At least he's making it obvious and nice and simple so we know what he stands for.
So we are run over time now, so yep. We do have to leave. But there will be a focus day on Saturday on tackling poverty, and which some of these questions may come up. So come to the events on Saturday and debate it then. You're also very welcome to stay on for our next event, which will be looking at the history of Africans in Europe, which proves to be really fascinating insight, again, into some of the history of inequalities that have developed in Europe. And I want to thank you for your engaged questions and coming along to hear us, and also to our panelists for their